Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, live from the WNYC studios in Soho. Thanks for sharing part of your day with us. Later in the week, we'll have some live music for you. We have an in-studio performance from the New Orleans rock band, The Revivalists. Some of my favorites, one of my favorites. They have a new album coming out, and they'll join us for a preview. That is happening on Thursday. And on Friday, we'll be joined by actor Nick Mohammed. You know him as Nate from Ted Lasso. He's also a comedian. He'll be performing in New York, and he'll join us on Friday. That is in the future. Right now, let's get into this hour, and we'll get it started with The Story of Art Without Men by Katie Hessel. Women are missing from art museums. A recent Williams College study found that 87% of the art found in major museums was made by male artists. And 85% of all art in these museums is from white and/or European artists. A major offender? London's National Gallery, where just 1% of the art is from women. The study goes on to say the balance is largely due to the dominance of male artists from the 19th century and earlier. That narrative is nonsense, according to British art historian Katie Hessel. Hessel has made it her mission to write women back into art history, going as far back as the 1500s in her New York Times bestseller, The Story of Art Without Men. Hessel spends more than 500 pages documenting the contributions to fine art. The book is in five parts, so we thought we'd talk about a section dedicated each day this week. And I've lost my second page of this introduction, so I'm looking for it right now. And I'm stalling, and I'm stalling, and I'm stalling. And here it is. We begin with the book's origins, and then a conversation about the section she calls Paving the Way, which covers the Renaissance, Baroque, and Rococo eras. So, Katie, I understand this book started from an Instagram account you began. What was the catalyst for the account?
Really, it began in October 2015. I was 21 years old and I walked into an art fair and I looked around me and realized out of all the artworks in front of me, not a single one was by a woman. And then I had to ask myself a series of questions. Could I name 20 women artists off the top of my head? Could I name 10 pre-1950, any pre-1850? The answer was no. I realized that I had essentially been looking at art history from a male perspective. And so really what I wanted to do, I went home that night. It is sort of what any millennial budding art historian would do. And I typed the words woman artists into Instagram and nothing appeared. And so I began my Instagram, The Great Woman Artists.
So when you decided to dive into this book and make this book, why did you choose the title The Story of Art Without Men versus The Story of Women in Art?
It's a great question. I mean, so there's a very famous book where I live in England called The Story of Art by E.H. Gombrich, and it was first published in 1950. And really, it was a book that I grew up and loved reading. I loved it for its pictures. I loved it for its accessible prose. But I realized when I was in my mid-20s, when I made this timeline of women artists from the last 1,000 years for the Tate Modern, and I looked up Gombrich's book because he's got a great timeline at the back as a reference point, and I realized that he didn't include a single woman artist in the entire book, and only does his 16th edition, the most recent one, include just one, that being Katia Kulvyt. So really, when we're thinking about the story of art, what we have been led to believe is essentially the story of art without women.
Hence the title, The Story of Art Without Men. So sort of the good news, bad news of this book is, the good news is that it is so thick and full of information and full of the names of women's artists. The bad news is we could never get to all of them, but we can certainly look at some of the cultural influences, some themes and name and collect a few names and stories along the way. So let's start with the Renaissance. One of the first, if not the first, recognized female Renaissance painter was a Dominican nun. Would you tell us her name and what were the conditions that led her to becoming an artist?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this the first section of my book is called Paving the Way. And really, the book spans from the last 500 years to the present day. And I begin in the Renaissance because really this is the time when we start to know about the names of women artists, especially. And so oftentimes, you know, history books will tell you that the Renaissance begins in the 1300s. But really, we first start to know about women in the 1500s. And one of the first known Florentine women artists is Plautina Nelli, who was extraordinary. She was born at the beginning of the 16th century, and unlike many female artists of her generation whose access to art and access to an artist's studio was actually through their father, she was a nun. And so she had access to manuscripts. She could copy works, and actually as a result she could form an all-female workshop from her fellow nuns. And what was extraordinary is that she made the first ever known Last Supper by a woman. And this is a work that was probably executed in around 1568. And it is remarkable. It is 7 by 2 meters. It shows, you know, Jesus and his apostles, you know, this sort of such acute accuracy to sort of lifelikeness. But the sort of tragedy is that it was hidden from view for 450 years until 2019, when it was first ever put on view in 450 years in the refectory of the Santa Maria Novella in Florence, which again, we have been starved by these stories for too long.
You mentioned fathers, and I found that to be interesting, that so many of the women who are mentioned in this book during this time period of the Renaissance, or the Renaissance, as you say, their fathers encouraged them, or their fathers made it possible for them. Who's an example of someone whose father was of great aid to her artistic pursuits? And are there any examples where family got in the way?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, in so many ways. I'm going to give you two examples. First of all, I'm going to tell you about Sofonisba Anguissola, who was a remarkable artist who worked in sort of portraiture and still life. Again, because I should add that women were banned from the life room until 1890s. That basic, education mm-hmm. in order to create these kind of grand, multi-figured biblical and mythological scenes. But really, they got around it by copying. And actually, Sofonisba Anguissola had the advantage of her father was a wealthy nobleman from Cremona, although he was actually cash poor, he was sort of status rich, so he had access to that. And he, interestingly, didn't have a son until his seventh child. And so really, his firstborn was Sofonisba Anguissola. And so he did everything in order to get her an apprenticeship. You know, he would write to Michelangelo, he would write to the Pope, he would send drawings across the Italian states to show the sort of splendor of his daughter. And really, she became a household name in the Italian states in the 16th century. And she was extraordinary because she worked in portraiture. So for example, there's a fantastic work in my book called Self-Portrait with Bernardino Campi. And this is one of her first ever teachers. It's from the 1550s. And, you know, he was able to get her an education in that way. And she painted her teacher dictating her appearance almost in a painting. But actually, when we think about it again, we see it's actually her dictating her teacher, dictating her appearance. And not only has she painted him 1.5 times as big as him, she's also painted him, you know, painting the embellishment of the jacket, something normally assigned to an apprentice. But if you look really closely, and actually a Pentimento discovered this in the 1990s, which is a sort of x-ray, that you actually see her hand guiding his, their wrists meet, which is extraordinary. And so this was a woman who, although was restricted to still life and portraiture, was happy to and found very interesting and canny ways to interweave different aspects, whether they be kind of challenging gender conventions or, you know, interweaving still lifes and landscapes in and around a self-portrait or a portrait of her sisters. And so in that way, she was hugely advantageous for her to have a powerful man and her father who supported her. But then, like so many other artists, you know, they actually were raised in their father's studio. And an example of this is someone called Artemisia Gentileschi, who was an extraordinary 17th century artist who worked in this kind of Baroque movement. And the Baroque movement, you know, it being this movement that was on the cusp of the 17th century, it was the greatest paint room was the Catholic Church. And it was really almost to kind of have these propagandistic portraits of biblical scenes, sort of dramatic, bloody, violent, exciting, visceral scenes to kind of steer people towards the Catholic Church because of the, what was happening in Northern Europe with the Reformation. And she grew up in her father's studio. Her mother died when she was very young, and she was tasked with raising her three brothers, but also working as an assistant to her father. And so, you know, she had this huge advantage. You know, by the age of 17, she was creating towering works such as Susanna and the Elders. She made extraordinary Judith Beheading Holofernes works. But you might say that one disadvantage of this was the fact that so much of her work was misattributed to her father, you know, after her death, which is also a huge issue when we think about women artists across history as well. So although it was advantageous, it's only really since the 80s, thanks to a scholar called Mary Garrard, that really so much of her work has been unearthed for the first time because it was attributed to her father, Orazio Gentileschi, who was a hugely successful and famous painter in the Baroque era, you know, who was friends with Caravaggio.
So Artemisia Gentileschi also, you know, she had this incredibly painful period of her life where she was raped, and the trial was really just a travesty, and she used her pain in her paintings. Would you explain what happened to her and how we see it in some of her work after?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting you raise this, but also because we have the documentation of this sort of 400-page manuscript of the court case that lasted for 7 months when she was forced to prove her innocence. You know, we hear her courageous voice. You know, she says, "È vero, è vero, è vero. It's true, it's true, it's true." And it's as though these people aren't believing her. And she, during the trial, was so she was raped by her father's friend, Agostino Tassi, who was an artist, sort of probably within the studios as well. So again, you know, this woman being exposed as a young woman to these men is obviously hugely hugely at a disadvantage as well. But it's the fact that during this trial, she was tortured with a sort of utensil called a sibile, which is essentially ropes tied around her fingers and tightened, almost like a kind of modern lie detector. But when we think about, you know, the hand of the artist is the most important thing, and that is the most abhorrent persecution for an artist. And really, you know, the trial lasted 7 months between 1611 and 1612. And after 1612, she was married off and she moved to Florence. And really, she thrived and she was extraordinary because she carried this kind of courage and this conviction with her, you know, wherever she went, but also in her paintings. So she immortalizes herself as St. Catherine of Alexandria, you know, this saint who was rescued by divinity, but also this saint who also looks at us whilst her hand is resting on a wheel of vicious spikes and a sort of feather in her other hand, and with this crown as well. And almost, you know, you could interpret her gaze sort of looking towards a distant memory that is quite painful. But what Artemisia Gentileschi did is she actually really immortalized the stories of female heroines. So she The likes of Judiths, the Susannas, the Lucretias, the Dianas, they really took center stage in her work. And I think what has made her such a sort of lasting legacy, as well as someone who lives in 2023 as a woman, is she really gives voice to the person. She gives voice to the woman. You know, when we look at her Susanna and the Elders, this subject that has, you know, tale as old as time, a woman, young virginal woman bathing in her garden when two lecherous men try and seduce her. When actually so much of the time in art history, this is depicted as a really kind of violent, a sort of almost glorification of violence against women. But when we see her version, she paints it with anguish and tension, as if to give voice to the woman of 17th century Rome.
My guest is Katie Hessel. The name of her book is The Story of Art Without Men. You note in the Baroque period that while women artists were not necessarily a curiosity any longer, they were by no means the norm. So what was the role of the female artist during the Baroque period?
I mean, really, that's in relation to somewhere like Bologna, which was extraordinary. And Bologna as a city had championed the work of women artists since the 13th century. You know, they championed women scholars, they championed women's education, but also as artists, as writers, as thinkers. You know, not only did they get them to sort of sign their own work to be you know, to sort of claim it as their own, but also this idea of them being remembered was so important as well. And really, you know, I think it's also because of the success of someone like Artemisia Gentileschi in Rome. You know, she was an international celebrity during her lifetime. I mean, it's crazy that it took centuries after her death for her name to be re-immortalized. But it's the fact that, you know, people were so mad about Artemisia Gentileschi, they would paint, they would commission portraits of her hand just so they can kind of get close to this divine-like essence. And so really, you know, it's a time of flourishment, especially in Bologna in the 17th century. You know, it's been recorded over 60 women artists working in the city. And that was thanks to people like Elisabetta Cerani, Lavinia Fontana. And really, these were household names. And it was thanks to people, you know, patronizing their work of all different classes and all different professions. And it was thanks to people championing their work, really.
You spoke about how Artemisia's father was given credit for her work. This was fascinating, that the work of Judith Lester was often attributed to Franz Hals.
It's correct, yes. I mean, you know, this idea of misattribution has long been an issue with women artists in art history. And with Judith Lester, who was a remarkable painter, you know, really prominent in the Dutch Harlem Guild in the sort of 1620s, really sort of one of the most prominent artists of the Dutch Golden Age. She was a contemporary of Frans Hals, and she was very well known. But she had a very short career. That was the issue, because actually after she was married off, she married an artist. She was actually tasked with being his assistant, as well as raising their five children. And really, after the later 1630s, her name fell into obscurity. And sort of as a result, you know, especially in the 19th century, dealers would actually be known to scratch out a female artist's name and replace them with a male contemporary, because it was a way for their work to get sold. And actually, it wasn't until a court case in 1897, which sort of contested this painting that was by Frans Hals at the Louvre, that they realized it was actually signed with a star. And that was Judith Leicester's thing, because her name was Judith Leicester. It means lodestar. And so she would always sign her work with a star. And they suddenly realized, because they worked in quite similar styles, that actually all these works were by her. But I mean, this is not even the start of this idea of misattribution. One of my favorite stories is actually a work that is by Marie-Denis Veillier. But how many people have heard of her? It was a work that was purchased by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1917 for $200,000, when it was under the impression that the famous neoclassical painter Jacques-Louis David had painted it. And so that also has to make us think about this idea of how we place monetary value on women in society as well. And would the Met have paid as much money for that painting had they known that it was by a woman?
Before we leave the 1700s, I do want to ask about art academies. There were art academies at this time. How much access did women have to formal art education? And if they did have any access, were they welcome?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating because, like I said, women couldn't even enter the life room until the 1890s. So really, that is the kind of first port of call in terms of even sort of being an artist at that time, sort of working in this academic style. So they were already at a massive disadvantage. They could attend some classes with the academies. There were artists such as Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun, who was part of the French Academy, but also they were very restricted. And the French Academy in Paris, they would actually cap the number of women artists admitted to four at a time. So really, you know, they were at such a disadvantage, and they had to really work around all these issues. And it was almost as though the academy was set up to exclude women, because what the academies did was they also kind of established this hierarchy between art forms, but also art genres. So, you know, painting and sculpture were at the top, and not only were painting and sculpture at the top, but when we think about those sort of hierarchies within that, you know, it was these grand biblical, mythological, multi-figured works, these history paintings that were at the top, and still life and portraiture were at the bottom. And what did women have access to? Still life and portraiture, because they could work on a domestic level. And so really, they were at such a disadvantage. But what was extraordinary is the fact that, you know, when we think about the Royal Academy of Arts in London, two out of the 36 founding members were actually women. Angelica Kaufman and Mary Moser, which was extraordinary, despite the fact that a woman wasn't even admitted to the Royal Academy until well over 100 years after that. But the fact that they were there is so important because these women were formidable. You know, they broke down boundaries. But also when it came to depicting the portrait of all the new academicians, actually, which is by Johann Zoffany, in 1771 to 1772, just a few years after the founding in 1768, what we see is all these men in suits, sort of decked around, all these men in suits, you know, gathered around this nude figure, you know, ready to sort of study the anatomy. And where are the women? They are immortalized in almost unrecognizable portrait busts in the corner as well, as if they weren't even allowed to be actually part of this. And again, when we think about how we immortalize people, how we immortalize stories, it's almost as they've been shunned and hidden from view.
My guest is art historian Katie Hessel. The name of her book is The Story of Art Without Men. Let's get to the 19th century. The first line of chapter 3 is, the 19th century was revolutionary for women. What are a few history-shaping and shifting moments that would impact women in the arts?
I mean, really, it's the admittance to the life room. That is what was so important. It's the fact that women were gaining more freedoms than ever. And really, when we look at the way that some women achieved monumental success during this era, that, I think, has to be called for. It's the likes of, you know, Rosa Bonheur with mm-hmm. realism. Again, because women couldn't access the life room, what she did, she turned to animal painting. And you know, she would, you know, she, as a kid, she would go to her local butcher and sort of study the carcasses of animals. And she would study days after days after days. And there's the most amazing painting by her at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York called The Horse Fair, which really earned her international recognition. This was a work that went on tour. This was a work that was, you know, made into prints. Again, this idea of sort of new technologies. The 19th century was the era of the Industrial Revolution, which meant so much, whether it be sort of new technologies. You know, we have to think about photography, printmaking. Again, these mediums that were more accessible to women than they had before, and also didn't have these kind of histories of patriarchy embedded within them like painting and sculpture had. But also, when we think about Rosa Bonheur, you know, she won the sort of French Legion of Honor for her work. She was internationally acclaimed. And this work, The Horse Fair, she studied for years. She went to a horse fair in Paris. And what she would do, she would get a special license in order to wear trousers, which she called her great protectors, in order for people to not realize she was even a woman, just to be sort of left alone like that.
Up until this point, we've been mostly discussing European women. So I want to bring in Edmonia Lewis, who you write about in your book, born a free black woman in 1844. And she worked with white marble as a sculptor. How did she begin her career?
I mean, Edmonia Lewis is one of the, I think, most remarkable artists in history. Just the fact that she even worked in marble as well. You know, this was a medium that not only sort of required, you know, prior anatomical skill and training, but also marble was expensive. So to sort of, it's so unheard of for artists, especially women artists, to use marble in history because, again, they had to have the right patron. She got started because she attended Oberlin College. She was very much encouraged by her brother, who was wealthy and could support her education. She then moved to Boston. You know, this was the 1850s. It was a really sort of politically changing time. And then in the 1860s, made her way to Rome, which is really where she thrived. And Rome during that time was home to a lot of women artists who were working in marble. And, you know, this sort of city of, you couldn't help but be sort of inspired by Rome as well when you think about what was happening around it, just the kind of splendors of the Roman architecture and sculpture. But also the fact that what she did, which was so special, is the fact that she carved in marble, you know, what might look like these kind of neoclassical sculptures were actually narratives of what was happening politically at the time. So for example, she's got this extraordinary work called Forever Free. And what we see here is actually of, you know, this was made in the aftermath of the abolition of slavery and the Emancipation Proclamation. And what we see here is this man and woman who are breaking from their chains because, and the fact that she could use these contemporary narratives was extraordinary. because it's almost as though, you know, when we look at this work, we see this kind of muscular and heroic male figure breaking from his chains and raising a clenched fist. And he is protecting the figure on the left, which who is an elegant free woman who kneels in prayer. Again, this symbol of the Emancipation Proclamation, and her eyes are wide, her expression hopeful. And this is what happens when we give, you know, artists who have so often been left out of the sort of one singular narrative that we see in art history, an opportunity. And the fact that she inspired a whole generation of artists and sculptors working in the Harlem Renaissance, such as Meta Vaux, Warwick Fuller, or Augusta Savage. And the fact that she broke through like Rosa Bonheur. It's the fact that actually what we see in the 19th century are these women who break through into the mainstream. You know, Edmonia Lewis was probably the most successful African-American sculptor of any gender in the 19th century.
Tomorrow, we'll continue our conversation with Katie Hessel, the author of The Story of Art Without Men, and learn about a woman who helped launch the Impressionist movement.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.